The world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. I am Priscilla March, and my husband and I live in Interlaken, New York, in the beautiful Finger Lakes region. I recently retired as a hospice nurse, and my husband as a professor at the University of New Hampshire. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. A special document called a vaccine passport may soon be required before you can go back to the things you used to do. We'll hear the latest.
Will vaccine passports become kind of standard fare? They already are. Period. They already are.
Also, a professor wins a court battle for free speech over which pronouns to use. Plus, how one couple is helping Chinese adoptees find their birth families.
When you get that match, and the adoptee's excited and the birth family's overjoyed, that is a rush like nothing else.
It's Thursday, April 1st. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Megan Basham. Good morning.
Time now for the news with Kent Covington.
Speaking in Pittsburgh on Wednesday, President Biden pitched his plan for another multi-trillion-dollar spending package.
It's not a plan that tinkers around the edges. It's a once-in-a-generation investment in America, unlike anything we've seen or done since we built the interstate highway system and the space race decades ago.
The price tag, roughly $2.3 trillion. The proposal, billed as an infrastructure investment, would devote about $620 billion to transportation-related upgrades, but critics say much of the bill has very little to do with infrastructure. The plan sets aside $400 billion for caregiving initiatives for the disabled and elderly, more than $200 billion is devoted to affordable housing, and the plan also calls for an array of environmental and green economy initiatives that the president says will create millions of good union jobs. The White House proposes paying for the plan in part by raising the corporate tax on foreign earnings from 21 to 28%. Republicans are not impressed. Texas Congressman Kevin Brady.
No president has ever raised business taxes trying to rebuild an economy from an economic crisis. I think at the end of the day, this will be the biggest economic blunder, frankly, of our lifetimes.
Democrats on Capitol Hill are signaling that they are once again prepared to use a process called budget reconciliation to pass the plan without any Republican support. The president is expected to unveil yet another huge spending plan later this month centered on child care, health care, and education. Together, the plans could cost up to $4 trillion. Pfizer announced Wednesday that its COVID-19 vaccine is safe and effective in kids as young as 12. That announcement could be one more step toward beginning shots in this age group before they head back to school in the fall. Pfizer's announcement came after a study of more than 2,000 U.S. volunteers between the ages of 12 and 15, including 12-year-old Caleb Chung.
Participating in this trial and potentially helping other kids to feel safe and want to get the vaccine in the future when it becomes publicly available was really some way that I could actually help out.
The study showed no cases of COVID-19 among fully vaccinated adolescents. Pfizer and its German partner BioNTech are in the coming weeks planning to ask the FDA and European regulators to allow emergency use of the shots starting at age 12. Two Capitol police officers injured during the January 6th Capitol riot are suing former President Donald Trump. World's Paul Butler reports.
Officers James Blasingame and Sidney Hemby sustained injuries in hand-to-hand combat as they tried to hold off Capitol intruders. And in a 40-page lawsuit, they say Trump is directly to blame for spawning the violent siege. Both officers are asking for unspecified compensation, along with damages of more than $75,000 each. Hemby said he's still receiving medical care for hand and knee injuries. Blasingame said rioters shoved him into a stone column and some hurled racial slurs at him. Both said they're still suffering emotional trauma. More than 100 officers sustained injuries during the riot, and one officer died the next day. Trump attorneys have maintained that the former president called only for a peaceful gathering and was not responsible for the Capitol siege. Reporting for World, I'm Paul Butler.
The Biden administration on Wednesday reversed Trump-era restrictions on transgender people serving in the military. Speaking at the Pentagon, Defense Department spokesman John Kirby announced newly revised policies.
They prohibit discrimination on the basis of gender identity or an individual's identification as transgender. They provide a means by which to access into the military in one's self-identified gender.
Transgender service members will also receive what the administration calls medically necessary transition-related care. The changes come after a two-month Pentagon review, which President Biden announced just days after taking office. The new rules are largely a reset to Obama-era policies and will be effective in 30 days. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has also called for a reexamination of the records of service members who were discharged or denied reenlistment under the previous policy. The Department of Justice is investigating GOP Congressman Matt Gaetz over a former relationship. The DOJ is probing allegations that the Florida lawmaker had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old girl. Gaetz emphatically denies any criminal wrongdoing and said he is the victim of an extortion scheme involving a former Justice Department official.
On March 16th, my father got a text message demanding a meeting wherein a person demanded $25 million in exchange for making horrible sex trafficking allegations against me go away.
Gaetz said his family has been cooperating with the FBI and said his father was wearing a recording device at the FBI's direction to, quote, catch these criminals. He also demanded that the Justice Department release the recordings. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy told reporters on Wednesday that it's too soon to make any determinations about the case.
I just read the story. Those are serious implications. If it comes out to be true, yes, we would remove him if that was the case. But right now, as Matt Gaetz says, this is not true and we don't have any information. So let's get all the information.
Gaetz went public about the investigation shortly after the New York Times first reported it. He said, quoting here, "No part of the allegations against me are true." I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, vaccine passports offer pandemic freedom, plus Cal Thomas on Georgia's controversial voting reforms. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Thursday, the first day of April, 2021. Thanks for joining us for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Megan Basham. First up, vaccine passports.
'Cause I've got a golden ticket.
Well, it's not a golden ticket that lets you into a mythic chocolate factory, but it may give you access to activities like international travel or indoor concerts. Remember those? So what's the catch? Well, World's Anna Johansson Brown has our story.
People keep wishing things would get back to normal. Unrestricted travel, indoor dining without seating limits, dragging yourself to a gym. Ah, the glory days. Well, Israel has already rolled out part of its solution, the Green Pass. If you've been fully vaccinated against COVID-19, or you can prove you've had COVID and are now immune, you get a stamp of approval that gives you exclusive access to gyms, hotels, theaters, pools, and concerts. This is the first back-to-normal concert in Tel Aviv. Everyone still wore masks, but they had access to a pre-pandemic luxury that most people have only dreamt about for the last year. Whether for international travel or a trip to the pub, vaccine certificates are fast becoming part of the new normal. Although, if you think about it, they've already been around for a while.
Will vaccine passports become kind of standard fare? They already are. Period. They already are.
James Hodge is a professor at Arizona State University. He specializes in vaccine law.
Healthcare workers in the United States every year got to get vaccinated for influenza. School kids going back to school got to get vaccinated. Colleges and universities, you're not arriving on campus if you're not vaccinated for measles, mumps, and rubella. You don't get to go to certain countries right now unless you're vaccinated for specific conditions.
For example, you can't go to some parts of Africa unless you've had the yellow fever vaccine. Hodge says international travel is pretty clear-cut.
Yeah, now your constitutional rights kind of stop at the door as you arrive at the EU. They can set their own conditions for whatever passport they feel is necessary to welcome you into the United Kingdom, France, Canada, or Mexico could do it. And if you want to enter, you will enter under their specific guidance.
But when businesses or states place restrictions, it gets a little more complicated, especially in the United States. Art Kaplan directs the Medical Ethics Division at the NYU School of Medicine. He doesn't think the U.S. government will start issuing vaccine mandates, at least not yet. But businesses? Absolutely.
Because a private business in the free market can require whatever the heck it wants. I can say, you can't come into this hotel unless you wear a 10-foot turban. It's the equivalent of saying no shoes, no shirt, no service. They can set conditions for coming in.
New York State recently announced that it would roll out an app called the Excelsior Pass. It lets people log their vaccination or negative test status. Then, if you want to go somewhere like Madison Square Garden, you have to present the pass to get in.
Remember, nobody has a right to go to Madison Square Garden. Nobody has a right to go on a cruise. I know people sometimes get their backs up and say, you can't make me do this. Well, it's true. Nobody can make you do it. But they can certainly say, you can't come in here, you can't go there. And they might even be able to say, I'm not going to hire you unless you show me that you're vaccinated.
But Kaplan admits that is going to create friction. Some people don't have access to the vaccine and won't for a long time, especially in poorer countries that don't have stockpiles to distribute. And some people, for health reasons or on religious grounds, don't want the vaccine. And those groups of people will be at odds.
You could have a two-class situation for a while, the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, with the vaccinated having a lot more liberty, freedom, movement to go where they want, easier to get employment.
There are dozens of apps and systems in development right now, and that means a whole lot of unknowns. What counts as vaccinated or immune? What if this app or this business allows the AstraZeneca vaccine, but this state or this organization doesn't? What about China's vaccine or Russia's? Do those count? Do you have to be vaccinated 2 weeks prior to the concert you want to go to, or only 10 days? What if vaccine immunity doesn't last forever, or it turns out you can still spread COVID even after you've been vaccinated? Art Kaplan says because of those unanswered questions, it might be jumping the gun just a bit to start requiring vaccine passports this early in the game. But businesses are desperate for anything that will allow them to return to normal. Dorit Rice teaches law at the University of California.
Businesses want to do two things. One is they want to avoid having to close down again or having to reduce activity again. And two, they want to signal, we're good actors. You don't have to hit us on the head with public health measures again.
Rice says it's important to have some kind of standards across the board, but maybe those should be up to trade organizations instead of governments. Art Kaplan says businesses should also keep in mind people who choose not to be vaccinated or who can't be vaccinated.
One way to accommodate is to say, well, I don't want to get vaccinated on religious grounds or even personal grounds or health grounds, but what I will do is get a COVID test every day.
That's not practical right now. Not everyone has access to a COVID test every day, but Kaplan thinks that could be where we're headed. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson Brown.
Up next, reining in university thought police. A federal appeals court waded into the debate over gender pronouns last Friday. A unanimous panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit upheld a Christian professor's right to not address students by their preferred pronouns.
5 years ago, Shawnee State University in Portsmouth, Ohio, disciplined Professor Nicholas Merriweather for declining to address a male student with female pronouns. That sparked a years-long legal battle over Merriweather's First Amendment rights. That battle has seen a few twists and turns. Here to fill us in on the case is Steve West. He's an attorney and writes about religious liberty issues for World Digital. Good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning, Mary.
Well, we touched on the origin of this case just a moment ago, but fill us in here, if you would, on what happened. A biologically male student wanted to be addressed as a female, and Professor Merriweather said what to that?
He said, no, I don't think I can do that. So if you just picture this interaction between them after class, the student who, by all appearances, is male, demands to be addressed with feminine pronouns. He's openly hostile. He's circling Professor Merriweather. He utters a profanity, and he tells Merriweather that he'll have him fired if he doesn't address him with the feminine pronouns. Yet To his credit, Merriweather held firm, and he reported the incident to school administrators. And what he told them was that he believed that God created human beings as either male or female, and that this sex is fixed in each person from the moment of conception, that it can't be changed, regardless of an individual's feelings or desires. And he also told him that he believed that he couldn't affirm as true an idea or a concept that is not true.
So that's what he said. Was that it? Is that the end of it? It's either my way or the student's way?
No, he offered a couple of alternatives. He said, look, I'll just use the student's last name and no pronoun. And initially, they said that was fine, but the student complained again.
And then what was the university's response to that?
Well, the school administrators then gave him an ultimatum. They said, address the student with feminine pronouns or else be disciplined. Once again, Merriweather suggested another accommodation. He said, well, what if I use the requested feminine pronouns, but place a disclaimer in the course syllabus explaining my views?
And I take it that wasn't good enough for the school.
No, it wasn't. In fact, astoundingly, the provost of the school laughed at him. The department head told him Christianity was based on fear and shouldn't be taught about at the school. And in the end, a letter of reprimand was placed in the professor's file indicating that he had created a hostile environment in the classroom with a warning that further action would be taken if he didn't shape up.
So it's at this point then that Merriweather sued to assert his First Amendment rights. And then I assume that case bounced around in federal courts for a while.
Right. Long process, but ultimately he lost in the trial court and then he appealed.
And Steve, what was Merriweather's legal argument and what was the school's counterargument?
Well, he said, this is about my right to free speech and free exercise of religion. He said, I know I can't say everything I want because I work for the university, which is a part of the state, and what I could speak about is more limited. But when I'm speaking on a matter of public concern and particularly in an environment that should be encouraging intellectual debate, I should be able to speak freely and consistent with my religious beliefs. He said the university was trying to compel him to speak words that he disagreed with. So the university, on the other hand, said this is no more than calling roll, basically. It's a perfunctory kind of thing, you know, the pronouns that you use, and we have a right to tell you how to do it.
And then last week, we get a ruling from the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. What did that ruling have to say?
Well, they were unanimous in overruling the trial court. They said a professor doesn't lose his or her First Amendment protection when they step into the classroom. And they emphasized how gender identity is a hotly contested issue of public concern and one on which professors have a right to freely speak, or in this case, not be forced to adopt a position by their speech that they disagree with. Judge Thaper said, if professors lacked free speech protections when teaching, a university would wield alarming power to compel ideological conformity.
So I think I know the answer to this. Is the battle over? Has Merriweather won?
Well, not yet. The case goes back to the trial court so that Merriweather can actually prove what he has said, all of which at this point, because of the way the case came up, the court has assumed. The school could also ask the full appeals court to hear it or ask the Supreme Court at this point to review it, but the odds are against either court taking it up. School administrators may also want to find a way to defuse this, but in the hypercharged climate that we're in, they face a lot of pressure to dig in and fight.
Mm-hmm. Steve, what does this ruling really tell us? Does it help to define the free speech and religious rights of educators across this country?
Well, I think in the university context, it'll signal strong protection for faculty to express their viewpoint on matters of public concern, whether they're teaching, whether they're involved in research or writing, even outside the classroom, like in social media and blog posts. Yet I think it'll also percolate through other areas like student speech in the university setting, where administrators have also adopted restrictive speech codes. I think it also recognizes that pronouns, the battle over pronouns, signals a deeper issue, an ideological battle being waged between transgender ideology and long-established views of sexuality and marriage. And at the very least, as this court has recognized, those topics need a robust debate. And what better place than the university?
Well, you've thought about this for some time now, Steve. Any final thoughts on this case?
Well, here's one. You know, this case also shows what can happen when one person stands up for what they believe and yet does so with respect and with grace. Professor Merriweather lived out Colossians 4, verse 6, where Paul says, "Let your speech be always gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer each person." That's a challenge to all of us.
Indeed it is. Steve West writes about religious liberties for World Digital. You can read his work at WNG.org and subscribe to his free weekly newsletter on First Amendment issues called Liberties. Steve, always good to have you on. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Mary.
Here's a story of perseverance for you. 17 years ago, a 50-year-old Polish man took Poland's driver's license test for the first time. Unfortunately, he didn't pass. Undeterred, he tried again and again and again, and he still hasn't passed. He's now taken the test 192 times, according to state media outlet TVP. He spent more than $1,500 in testing fees. But perhaps history contains a lesson for him and all of us. In 2009, a 68-year-old South Korean woman passed her driver's license exam after taking it more than 900 times. Wow. It's the world and everything in it. Today is Thursday, April 1st. We're glad you've turned to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Megan Basham. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, international adoption. For almost 40 years, China's Communist Party enforced its one-child policy to curb the country's growing population. The Chinese government says the policy prevented 400 million births through abortions and forced sterilizations.
The policy had many consequences, including so-called excess children filling up Chinese orphanages. So in 1991, China began allowing international families to adopt thousands of Chinese children. Over the next 25 years, Americans took home more than 80,000 of those children. Now, some of them are trying to find their Chinese birth families. But that's no easy task. World's Sarah Schweinsberg met up with a couple in Utah trying to help.
All right, so I don't know how you want to do this, but when I started scrapbooking the old-fashioned way.
Brian Stye and his wife, Long Lan, sit at their kitchen table, stacks of scrapbooks spread between them. These picture books tell the birth stories of the couple's three daughters. Makina, Megan, and Milan. Each of them adopted from China as toddlers.
So I would put their, you know, their stories and try to kind of give them an idea of where they were from.
In the 90s, Brian Stye began seeing news stories about how, under the one-child policy, Chinese families were abandoning baby girls on the sides of roads. He wanted to help. So in 1998, with his first wife, he adopted Makina from a Chinese orphanage.
And it was such an amazing experience on so many levels.
4 years later, and after a divorce, he adopted his second daughter, Megan. Brian adopted Makina and Megan from two different orphanages, but both places told him similar stories. The girls' families abandoned them along a road or under a tree. That was a common story. But Brian wanted to be able to tell his daughters more specifics. So he returned to China. A Chinese shopkeeper named Long Lan offered to help Brian do research. Together, Long Lan and Brian tracked down Megan's newspaper finding ad. That's a picture of each child the Chinese government publishes in a newspaper. It lets the public know the state has custody.
And seeing that, I was like, oh, and color, it was full color ad. I was like, this is amazing.
Brian decided other adoptive American families would also want their child's ad.
And so we just loaded up as many of these newspapers as we could, carried them home, got them
in a closet. They still have stacks of newspapers with thousands of pictures of babies.
We have all of these.
Yeah, those are all the
finding ads.
Finding ads.
Long Lan reads Megan's ad.
It says she was found on July 14, 2000 at the Haizhou Hospital, Guangzhou City.
After that first research trip, Brian Stye and Long Lan decided to take many others. They got married, adopted their third daughter, Meilan, and created ResearchChina.org, a service to help connect Chinese adoptees with their birth families. The Stais visited orphanages all over China.
So the families were primarily just interested in, hey, go take a picture of where my daughter was found.
But as they interviewed orphanage directors and studied data, the Stais began to doubt the stories about how the children had been abandoned. They noticed odd patterns.
They would use the same finding locations over and over and over again.
Their suspicions were confirmed in 2010 when Long Lan returned to Mekina's orphanage. She tracked down the two women listed in Mekina's paperwork as her finders. That's who finds an abandoned baby and brings it to an orphanage. Long Lan says one of the women made a startling admission.
Be honest with you, I never find your daughter. Because for your daughter's, you know, adoption, they just need a name, you know, to put it on the paperwork. That's it.
They also discovered Megan's finding story was made up, as well as Milan's. The one-child policy had created the perfect opportunity for child trafficking. The Stais say the government's family planning services would pressure and threaten families to give up children, especially baby girls. Then officials would lie to the Chinese families, saying the child would be adopted by someone in a nearby village. Orphanages would also pay traffickers and officials for these babies.
And instead of going to a family in the next village, they go to the orphanage and they receive 2,000 yuan. And then the child is adopted internationally.
Then the orphanages would lie to the international families, telling them the babies were unwanted. Then families would pay up to 40,000 in today's dollars to adopt a Chinese baby. These revelations made the Stais' work feel even more significant. Now it was about bringing peace to both adopted kids and birth families looking for their children. In their basement office, Brian and Long Lan work side by side behind computers.
And so we have created this huge spreadsheet, and then you can,
from the finding ads, they've built spreadsheets of Chinese children who were put up for adoption. One province alone had 30,000 children. Long Lan is also creating a database of Chinese birth families looking for their kids.
Yeah, most of them ask, hey, have you found my daughters?
The Stais then ask the birth families and adopted children to submit DNA samples.
We have decided the best way to search for a birth family is just to test as many birth families as possible. It's just a numbers game.
When they find a DNA match, they link the family back together. So far, they've connected more than 80 adopted Chinese children with their birth families.
When you get that match, and the adoptee's excited, and the birth family's overjoyed, mm-hmm. and the birth family is crying because they know that their child is alive and healthy and happy, mm-hmm. that is a rush like nothing else.
For many adopted children, it's also healing to learn that they were loved.
I think the moment soon that they know this story, I think they're happy that they never abandoned. That would be one of the reasons.
Brian and Long Lan Stai are still looking for Mekina and Megan's birth families. So they'll keep collecting DNA, one birth family at a time.
If we stop, who will do it?
Yeah.
That's the problem. There is nobody else that will do it. That means that there's going to be adoptees and birth families that'll never be reunited.
Yeah.
And so, to this point, that has convinced us to continue to do it.
Reporting for World, I'm Sarah Schweinsberg in Lehigh, Utah.
Additional support comes from Wilberforce Weekend, a world-class event from the Colson Center that explores your God-given calling and His restorative work in the world, May 21st through 23rd. More at wilberforceweekend.org. From Pensacola Christian College, empowering Christian leaders to influence the world. More at go.pcci.edu/world. And from the podcast, Too Busy to Flush, one couple's slightly irreverent musings on faith, food, family, and marriage. TooBusyToFlush.com.
Coming up next, a preview of Listening In. This week, host Warren Smith talks to New York Times bestselling author Ellen Vaughn. Her latest project is a biography of missionary Elizabeth Elliot. Her husband, along with four other missionaries, were killed in 1956 by members of the Alca tribe in Ecuador. The media attention catapulted her to international prominence.
For her biography, Ellen Vaughn had unparalleled access to Elizabeth Elliot's journals and personal letters. Through this very private lens, Vaughn captures a very different side of one of the 20th century's most well-loved evangelical authors.
I think what I loved and what I related to was her journey from being a very dutiful, know all the right answers in your head, raised in the Christian home, knows all five verses of every hymn, every scripture verse, also being very intellectual in her faith. That person who maybe had been living a bit in legalism, and then in Ecuador, all kinds of stuff breaks loose. And it's not just Jim Elliot's violent death. It was other deaths that happened to Elizabeth Elliot in the jungle that are mostly revealed again in these journals. And the sense of, wait, God is not the picture I had in my head. He is far more mysterious. This life is not just a matter of, oh, well, God did this so A and B and C and D could happen. And it's all tidy and we see the glorious triumphal ending for the kingdom. She really bucked against that tide, that spinning of the story that sadly can be human nature and certainly was expressed a lot in sort of the triumphal missionary stories of the 20th century. So what I loved, what surprised me was her humanness, her foibles, her weaknesses, and at the same time, her liberating discovery of who God really is, apart from just the images.
That's Ellen Vaughn talking to Warren Smith. To hear their complete conversation, look for Listening In tomorrow, wherever you get your podcasts. Today is Thursday, April 1st. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Mary Reichard. Commentator Cal Thomas now on the effort to prevent voter fraud.
At his news conference last week, President Biden said Georgia's new voting law, quote, makes Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle. The term Jim Crow came from a song written by Thomas Dartmouth Daddy Rice. He was one of the first performers to wear blackface makeup and modeled his Jim Crow skit after an exaggerated, highly stereotypical black character. He first performed the skit in 1828. By 1832, the character was a staple in minstrel shows. According to the Jim Crow Museum of Racist Memorabilia, quote, white audiences were receptive to the portrayals of blacks as singing, dancing, grinning fools, unquote. President Biden and other Democrats apparently want us to believe America has made no racial progress since then. Democrats should display some humility when it comes to African Americans and voting. It was members of their party who opposed civil rights legislation, defended slavery in the 19th century, and promoted black codes in southern state legislatures that denied many rights to former slaves. Those were elected Democrats who stood in schoolhouse doors denying access to black children. Democrat sheriffs clubbed people in the streets during demonstrations and sicked dogs on them, among other indignities. It was also the party that required poll taxes and literacy tests for blacks, violating their right to vote. The Georgia law leaves in place many voting options in addition to showing up on Election Day. It eliminates signature matching, which should appeal to both parties. Vote tabulators will no longer have to subjectively decide the authenticity of two signatures. Instead, voters will receive an ID number with their mail-in ballots or applications. Those numbers must match. In-person voters who do not have an ID card can easily obtain one. How is it racist to do a better job of ensuring ballot integrity and boosting confidence in election outcomes? The Georgia law seeks to prevent vote harvesting and voting by people who don't exist or moved out of state. And it's now being duplicated in other states with Republican-majority legislatures. Today's Democrats like to claim voter suppression when Republicans attempt to make sure every ballot is legitimate. But we can't afford to repeat the claims of suspect voting behavior, miscounting, and questions about machines and illegal voters that Donald Trump lobbed at the 2020 presidential election. Most people are willing to accept the defeat of their candidates if they believe the system was fair and the tabulations accurate. That's what the new Georgia law aims to do. It has nothing to do with Jim Crow, or for that matter, Jim Eagle. I'm Cal Thomas.
Tomorrow, Culture Friday, and I'll review the new musical, A Week Away. It's about a juvenile delinquent at a Christian youth camp. That and more tomorrow. I'm Megan Basham.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord. Go now in grace and peace.